Hi, everyone, and welcome to season 3 of the Engaging Gray podcast, where we explore what it means to live engaged in the complex, ambiguous, and messy reality that is life. I'm Mary DeYoung, founder of Gray Space Collaborative, an intentional collector of diverse experiences, and your host for this podcast. All right, hi, everyone. Thank you so much for joining us on yet another episode of Engaging Gray podcast, where we engage all things gray, messy, and wonderful. Today, I have John Huckins here with me, and I'm super excited to have this conversation because while John and I don't spend an exorbitant amount of time together, the time that we have spent together has been formational for me, and so I hope that it will be formational for all of you. John, thank you for joining us today.
You bet. Fun to be with you, Mary. It's been a bit. And it's been good a bit. Always to see your face.
So, John, we talked about when I asked you to join this podcast, I had mentioned that we are talking about change. And for the past decade plus, you have been inviting people into spaces of conflict in order to be a catalyst for change and deeper connection and reflection. But we often experience such an aversion to conflict. And so can you describe a little bit about why, when you were like, this sounds like a really good idea to pitch to people, I'm sure they'll want to navigate and jump into conflict with me. Like, tell us a little bit about why conflict as a catalyst for change.
I mean, it was very personal, honestly. As I looked at my own story, the moments where I had the most profound awakening, even you could call them conversions, mini conversions, worldview expanding, heartbreaking, vision aligning moments happened in places where I was out of control. And I was in places where there was difference and conflict, if you will, that created a level of dissonance in me that required a series of really hard questions to be asked. And the most profound moment was when I was first in Palestine, Israel. And I went as a young seminarian with all these great intentions of learning the Bible in its context and hearing about Jesus and all these Holy Land sites, which is cool. But what I discovered were individuals on the ground who, in the midst of a very polarized, conflicted region, historically and present, were living incredibly compelling lives that were upsetting the status quo of inherited narratives that we are to hate our enemies, and they're saying actually refuse to be your enemy. Narratives that said a certain religious group or ethnic group was to be prioritized. And in their lives, they're saying we actually have a common humanity that binds us. And as I was experiencing these people and these relationships in the midst of this conflict, it forced me to ask a ton of questions about, man, what have I inherited from my Western worldview and theology and leadership structures that I need to confront, because I think I've actually been on the wrong side of some of these equations. And so conflict, you know, one of my mentors in this is a guy named John Paul Lederach. He describes conflict as is the most profound laboratory for transformation. If we actually move towards conflict and try to learn from it, we will experience transformation not only in ourselves, but we can experience transformation on a societal level. And I just began to believe, like, hey, if we just get more people uncomfortable, we might wake up to our blind spots. We might move into the gray, if you will, and be forced to have to reconcile with our inherited system structures, worldviews, theologies, and see what a more hopeful way is.
There's a lot of really good nuggets there. And the first thing that stuck out to me was when you talked about being out of control. And do you believe, or in your experience, how often does being in control or wanting to be in control impact our ability to change?
A lot and often. I mean, in every aspect of control is, in my opinion, is a bit of a myth. I mean, if we are confronted with the reality of our world or just the changing dynamics of everything from ecology to relationships, we can only control so many things. There's a pseudo level of control I think we grasp onto. And out of our desire for stability, we hang on to it with all we can. We kind of white knuckle it. And as we do that, we miss opportunities to become more whole humans. We miss opportunities to build new relationships. We miss opportunities to maybe awaken to a future that we otherwise would just kind of lie dormant. And I think a lot of our institutions, whether in nonprofit world or business world, are designed to sustain a myth of control. Like if we have enough spreadsheets in place, if our org chart is a certain way, if my position is clean enough in my titling, then I can kind of can curate a pseudo control, which might be a season of stability, but I don't know if it's control. And if it is control, then we probably start to live in a level of self. We lack awareness of the position line. So that's kind of abstract, Mary. I'm not sure if that's exactly what you're looking for, but I think control is an inhibitor.
No, I really appreciate it because I do feel like when we run into things, right? I work with organizations all the time. They're just like, well, what do we do so that we know we get the right employee, the perfect employee every single time?
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm like, y'all, you deal with people, like human beings. And so you can't. Like, A, you're flawed. B, they're flawed. And C, things change.
Mm-hmm.
And so even if you find your process works great and you find the right person, things could happen or change for them in their life and they're no longer the right person. Yep. That doesn't mean you made the wrong decision then. It doesn't mean that they were being insincere. It just means that things change.
Totally.
But the willingness, and I don't want to say willingness necessarily. I think that sometimes it's a willingness. And I think honestly, sometimes it's an ability issue is the ability to accept that. The ability to accept that things are outside of our control or that this person may do things that I do not like and I can still love them to the point of your story of like, I don't have to be in control of you and you don't have to behave how I expect you to in order for me to love you.
Mm.
There is something that is different about folks that have that grounding or that ability than folks that don't. Right. That's been my, like, would you agree with that statement? And if so, like, what are some of the things that you've seen that help folks find that grounding?
Yeah. First off, I would say it's an understandable disposition to want control. So I don't want to speak in a way that's like dismissive of it.
Sure.
I think the time. World, totally. Me oh too. I mean, the world is chaotic and grasping for control, especially if some of us struggle with anxiety or different things, like to have some level of control or a feeling of control can help our, even on a molecular level, we feel more grounded.
Even predictability. And this is why I always tell people, look, I love Law and Order, not because I love law, but because I know that by the end of the episode, they've caught the bad guy and we are like happy. Like it wraps every time. It's like it's so predictable.
Button that up.
I love that. Life is not that way. And so, and it all happens in an hour when in like real life, this is like years in the making. Right. But like, so I'm with you. I totally get it. And right. Sometimes the things that we desire or that we are drawn to are not always healthy and helpful for us.
Mm-hmm. 100%. So. And I think what I see in, I guess I'll speak, this could be humans, but I'll speak specifically to leaders that exhibit a desire to constantly be open to change and actually see it as a beautiful, necessary part of life, are those that one are grounded in who they are. Like they don't need to control so that they can continue to construct a pseudo identity and image that they just need to project to the world. They're grounded in who they are. And so because they don't need to control the narrative, if you will, about the way they're perceived in the world, they can open their hands and they can listen and get curious and be open to make changes. I see those that have given themselves to diverse relationships, maybe even diverse spaces, and they've come to the end of their control, and on the other end of it, they saw the opportunity of growth and change through the voices of those that have a very different worldview. And so now those leaders are saying, I'm going to proactively reach out to put myself in those places. That's going to push back a lot of against some of maybe my own biases or my blind spots. And I'm going to see change as a cultural imperative for not only who I am as a leader, but the kind of culture I create in my organization. Mm-hmm. They've had to be proximate to that, the beauty of that change themselves. Like I don't think it's something you can just teach with bullet points. It's like, hey, come experience the gift of diverse space and how that changes you, which is why I've been a believer, like you said, for the last 13 years of, hey, what if the methodology or the modality for change or transformation is by putting ourselves in situations where we're out of the driver's seat and allow ourselves to be intentionally displaced or disrupted from our norms and allow that to create the kind of space for us to be awakened to something new, something beautiful, or a personal change that needs to happen.
When I first encountered you, it was through Global Immersion and through an immersion trip. And I remember really being struck by this immerse and experiential learning, because we do, and especially in some of the work that I do, like around cultural intelligence work or, you know, things like that, people want to like, well, what book should I read?
Yeah.
And I'm like, hey, books can be really helpful, but at some point it has to get off the page. This is like, you know, when you talk to people and they're like, oh, I can always tell doctors when they're like, I can always tell when people have watched a lot of Grey's Anatomy because they think they can come in and like, you know, start diagnosing. And we misinterpret knowledge for experience or for understanding, right? Like knowledge does not equal deep understanding.
Totally.
Experience and relationship bring understanding, right? Mm-hmm. I don't think that we always have to experience the exact same thing as someone in order to have understanding. Right. When we have deep relationship and interest in that way. Mm-hmm. But it is difficult, right? So and it is very counter to often how we are taught as leaders to be, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And so how have you seen folks transition from that? That's a change in and of itself, just the willingness to say, I'm willing to entertain an idea that being a leader can look different than knowing all the answers.
Yeah, yeah.
What are some of the catalytic things that you've seen for folks, and what are the pieces that have supported them in that transition or in that change from changing from, I've got to know everything, that is my role, that is my responsibility to be the person who knows everything, leads, protects, provides, whatever, to I can say I don't know, and I can ask for help, and I can lean on others, and I can, you know,
yeah,
whatever that looks like.
I mean, the hardest way for a leader that I've experienced and worked with to come to that place is they destroy the world they're in. They destroy their organization or their relationships because they haven't been willing to embrace that posture for change, and it's hurt so many people that their world implodes. And you see that happen over and over, especially with the dominant culture male leaders that I work with oftentimes, who have inherited constructs that are set to benefit us and to sustain a status quo that has us in control. And when they don't listen to those around them and they kind of create this ongoing myth, then everything breaks down, whether it's their marriages or their teams or the culture that they're part of finally starts pushing back on them. And then they're like, they have to, like, almost like an addict has to hit rock bottom before they say yes to healing. Those leaders sometimes have to hit rock bottom in order to say that didn't work. So what's a better way?
Sure.
I think others have had some kind of personal experience with a relationship or a space that said, this is important to my formation. And then they create the infrastructure to keep that going. Like, I remember taking a group of professors to the border here in Tijuana, San Diego, like you experienced on this immersive journey. One of the professors was writing like one of the most academic books on immigration, like a theology of immigration and how it intersects with the border. Wicked smart dude, to your point around like lots of knowledge.
Yeah.
But as he was experiencing the proximity to all of these concepts he was writing about and to the people and to those, whether it's Border Patrol agents or spending the night in a migrant shelter, his knowledge was being kind of reshuffled in such a way that that whole academic project took different form. But to his credit, he was like, I have to, as part of my journey, I have to put myself in these positions. And so it's like there's these leaders who make intentional decisions to know it's going to probably be less efficient. It'd be way more efficient if he just buttoned that book up with the knowledge he had than to go on an experience that nuanced or changed some perspective and then have to go further. And I think that's a learning for us as leaders that it's not an efficient journey. I think it's the healthy and healing and whole journey that we go on. And but we need advisory teams and board members who believe in that too, who are going to hold us accountable to those practices that open us up to change and to new awakenings. If there's not an infrastructure there, I think a lot of leaders can kind of just go siloed and presume they are learning and growing when everyone around them is like, no, you're not. So there's a level of like, of humility and trust that they need to set in motion around them.
Yeah.
If they're going to take this seriously.
Well, that's, I mean, I say this all the time. Simple things are not easy things. Just because it is simple, like you need people, doesn't mean it's easy to find them or to listen to them. Just because, you know, like, just because we say it simply, like this is what it is, doesn't mean we're also saying it's easy. We recognize that it's not.
Totally.
Right. And, you know, this is one of the big reasons when I talk to folks about why, how my coaching is different. I said, it's because like, I have to come and observe you. Like, I'm not one of those coaches that will like, just fill in my questionnaire and then like, let's go. I take you fully at your word. I believe you that is how you perceive it. I need to now go and witness it for myself, right? Because how many, I mean, if you've been an employee in an organization and your boss is like, yeah, I got a coach. You're like, oh, thank goodness. Somebody's going to tell them, right?
Totally.
And then you're like, wait, I've never seen the coach here. I've never seen that person. Right. How would they know what's happening? Oh, well, I tell them. It's like, oh, well, now we have a breakdown, right? Because you're not proximate. You don't actually know what the world is that person is navigating or how they actually are showing up in that world.
Yep.
And when you talk about relationships and that ability to have that advisory board, there's, I would posit that there's a key piece of saying you have to also not just like keep your board over here, right? 100%. And that you can go to them, but they need to have access and windows into who you are and what you're doing so that they can also put a flag on the play and be like, whoa, that was not in alignment with what you said your goals are, or you aren't, or what you say your values are. Help me understand what, you know, what's going on here. Do I not have the full picture? Or, but there's a secondary piece of invitation or access that we don't often invite people into. At least it's been my experience. It's hard to invite people in. It's hard to share that you're not doing it right.
Yeah. Or to even give people the keys to potentially say that you're not doing it right. Like usually those people are going to be your champions, and the questions they're asking are kind of coming out of a desire for good. But I do think, to your point, we have to be willing to give the keys to a collective of people, and not only for our own formation and willingness to change, but for our teams. Like if our team knows that that someone else has the keys to me and is asking me those hard questions, the rest of the team can be at ease. Like this person, this leader is not going to go rogue on us. Like you're saying, wait, they're, oh, great. They have a coach now, but where are they? Like there is, I think, organizational culture that's really strengthened when everyone knows that the leader has a community that has keys to their blind spots, or to their formation, or their to this decision making, it's huge. But it's hard, and it's not efficient, and it's uncomfortable. So a lot of leaders don't do that.
No, we don't. And I don't judge people for not doing that.
Yeah.
Right? Because it also requires, when you say, like, you mentioned proximity. I love that language. We have to be proximate in order to recognize that something is maybe amiss, or to be able to start to ask questions. But we also have to have had experience. Like, you can't imagine what maybe you haven't seen, right? This is why we often talk about representation being so important. Yeah. And why, you know, you have to know that you can ask someone to do that for you. You know, you need to know that you can ask or invite, and somebody's not going to just like tear you down, right? There needs to be some sort of experience. And that is a slow process. And I think that's what good coaches can do, right? Is to say, like, you can actually experience this in a way that doesn't make you feel like a terrible human being.
Totally.
You know? The other, along with this, along with the willingness to change, there's, and in some ways, going back to the control of willing to let certain things go that we've held as our anchoring points. I work a lot with founders, and so oftentimes anchors are like the thing that they've created. Well, this is my purpose. This is the thing that I'm working for. And it can be for decades. And then all of a sudden, either they need to retire, their team is like, please retire. Or, you know, I also work with a lot of founders that their team is getting really upset because they're still acting like an entrepreneur when their team is like, no, we're an established business now. Yes. You need to stop adding stuff. Like, it's too much. Right. And so either way, we get into spaces in which founders are either asked to leave or finding it necessary to leave. And that is such a difficult thing because it's been such a, this is what I'm doing, and their handhold for so long. You have just recently transitioned out of something you've built. Can you talk to us a little bit about what that process was like of letting go of something that you've spent so long building and believe so much in?
Yeah. Yes, I can. And it hasn't been easy. It's been good and right. But I mean, to the founder thing, it's like, every founder has a founder's story. And I know that can become this founder's myth that can be critiqued as well. Cause then like the founder's myth is what everyone knows. Like, oh, look what they did to, you know, and we can believe our own myths and think we're so important. But there's also a level of, like, for me at least, co-founding an organization out of the blood, sweat, and tears and belief in a vision and another world being possible. Like this is what I gave to Global Immersion for it to become what it is more than I've given to anything other than my wife and kids. I mean, it's because I believe in it so much and still do, that we can actually have tools to transform conflict in our personal relationships, in our society, in the world at large. It matters. And it also, for founders, comes usually at a sacrifice. Like the first few years of founding Global Immersion, there was no income. It was all moonlight, like late nights, blood, sweat, and tears, too much travel, young kids, like crazy. And so there's also that kind of piece that a lot of founders have where we kind of tether ourselves. Like, we've sacrificed so much to this thing. Now it's time for that organization to give back to me because, like, I put my time in. And because we believe in it so much, we do start to marble our identity with the thing that we built. And I know for me, that's been ongoing. Like, part of my biggest formation in the last 5 years has been, who am I outside of Global Immersion? And what are ways that my title or proximity to Global Immersion has actually interrupted my ability to understand who I am as John Huckins and as one deeply loved beyond anything that I've accomplished or achieved or built with Global Immersion? And it's been a very beautiful and liberating, and it actually, I think, allowed me to do some of my best work with Global Immersion because I was no longer needing to kind of like pull all the levers or, you know, make the puppet dance a certain direction because I needed it to feed my own ego or kind of pseudo understanding of control or power or whatever. So all that to be said, I understand why founders stay long, long time, or get to the point where like the teams boot them out. I'm thanked be to God I wasn't booted out. This is very much a decision we made, my wife and I, as a healthy next step. But that didn't make the change easy. It made it clear, like for me to step into the things I'm to contribute in this next season of life, I needed to go on a journey that said change is not, there's these myths of change I think a lot of us have, like change is abandonment, change is bad or it's failure, especially if you started, founded something. To shift the language to actually, I think change is a constant. I think change can actually be a completion rather than abandonment. Like I've completed my time here, I've done good work and I can step away from that. It's an opportunity to trust beyond myself, but to let go of the control and trust that something that's been built can flourish beyond me. Like it doesn't need me anymore. That's a humbling, but also I think a very healthy thing to come to terms with. And change, it's ecological. That was some helpful language for me in this. It's like seeds are planted, things grow. In order for them to flourish into the future, they have to die. And then in the spring, you start to see new life come. Like there is an ecological cycle to not only to the created order, but I think in how we as human beings interact with different spaces and get different commitments in our life. And this is one of them. Like the dying, if you will, or the stepping away isn't a bad thing. It's actually something that can lead to life. You know, the organization I led, Global Immersion, to white guy founders, that organization needs to be more diverse. We've said that forever. So if me stepping away allows the new life to look like the world we actually live in, thanks be to God. I hope that my displacing myself could create more space for diversity in that sense. And I think, sorry, this is a long answer, but one other thing that was helpful for me is not just Parker Palmer, who's a Quaker leadership teacher, guru, he talked about this time he was offered a presidency of a university and he was about to take it. But he circled around him what's called a clearness committee. In the Quaker tradition, you just have people that come and ask you questions to draw out inside of us what it is that we need to do. And one of them said, why is it you want to take this role as president of this academic institution? And as he was very honest with himself, he said, because I want to have my face in the paper. And one of the people in the clearness committee says, isn't there an easier way to get your face in the paper? Like, don't do something just because you think it's going to look cool or it's going to feed your ego or it's going to build your resume. Do the thing you're here to be about and it's going to make your heart come alive. And so he describes it as like this practice of understanding way closing. Sometimes we don't know what we're moving towards, but we know we're done with a certain thing. Like the door's closed behind us. And so we kind of orient our eyes to what's next. Mm-hmm. Some of that was for me, it's like, okay, this seems like the end of a chapter. So what's the opportunity and invitation for me into the future? And hopefully not one that's just driven by ego so I can get my name in the paper, but to like, this is my best contribution I can offer the world. So
thank you for sharing that story and for being so transparent about like the difficulty and the process and all of the different pieces that it's had to be, right? Like it's had to be a decision between you and your spouse. It had to be a decision that wasn't necessarily easy, but it was still clear, and being comfortable and confident in that clarity, despite maybe not having the next, right? Mm-hmm. And so often we want to know like, well, am I leaving for something better?
Right.
Is there something else that's better? And I don't know, I feel like MapQuest, right? You used to have to get it on a computer and then
print that baby out.
Print it out and then bring it with you. And now we have like Google Maps that just tells you turn like one turn at a time. Mm-hmm. But it's interesting that I often think about this. I'm sorry if you can hear my dogs in the background. This is what home podcasting does.
You bet. Bring them.
Okay. Yep. They're loud.
Listen to them. They're really on it right now.
They're really on it. They are very good guard dogs, except that they protect us really from the whole spectrum of
things. The wind, even. Yes, hey, wind, get away.
It moved. The tree moved. There must have been a squirrel. So let's keep it away. I apologize. But when, like, I often think about, we just trust so innately in our Google Maps.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Oh, we don't even necessarily always look ahead. We're just like, yep, turn by turn by turn by turn. We're not even paying attention when we're just going. And we don't often have that trust with anything else, you know? Mm-hmm. But how also freeing it is sometimes, because I remember driving, I have this very distinct memory of driving through downtown Chicago. And it's really one highway, but on MapQuest, it was like four different highways. All you had to do was stay straight. That was literally all you had to do. But on MapQuest, it was like, take this highway. And so we would be panicking. Where's the sign for the highway? You know, we'd be like trying to look, because we were always trying to look ahead and trying to understand where we were going rather than just like trusting, you know, the one direction. And I think about that oftentimes when we talk about trusting the next step how, you know, even when, you know, when I talk to founders, I'm like, well, if you had known all of this at the beginning, you probably wouldn't have started.
Yeah.
You know, because totally. you would have been like, yeah, let me weigh the pros and cons of like all of this time away with like the no income and this and this. And is there a more practical way of doing things? Like, you probably would have chosen differently.
Yep.
Maybe, but you might have chosen differently if you had all of that information. Sometimes being naive about how hard something is going to be is actually a really powerful thing. Sometimes just taking a leap of faith or trusting in who you are and what you're excited about, like at one point that was enough. Mm-hmm. And we sometimes get away from that. I think sometimes when we've built something, we feel like we have more to lose.
Yep.
That becomes not enough anymore.
Yep. Yep. Yeah, and we kind of lose some of the flair for what we're even. I think there is a space to build those systems that can be sustained. But I think a good question for the founder is, if this is baked into some of our DNA, kind of entrepreneurial spirit, where have we kind of been? Where have we become numb to the stuff that at one point was getting us out of bed, and then we can just kind of maintain a status quo that keeps us in our places of security, but like, maybe that should be handed to someone else so you can start your other thing. There's this poem by John O'Donohue. He's a Celtic theologian. And he talks about he talks about each one of us being invited to an unfurled future. The poem is using this metaphor of sails, that we can often like tuck away our sails in the corner in the shadows. Mm-hmm. But the sails reflect us when we are fully alive. Like, you unfurl your sails and let the wind sweep you into that unfurled future. And to me, it's like, even though this change I'm in right now has actually been very hard in a million ways, even though I know I feel very grounded and at peace with it, the liberating moments are like, oh, what is that unfurled future? Let me wake up to that. And that's the stuff of like life. Like, we are all in formation. We are not the same person we were yesterday. Our cells are always replicating and moving and morphing. And what is the person I am today that I wasn't 13 years ago when I started a global immersion? And what's the unfurled future for that? Mm. And how are we all asking that question each day? And it might not look like a big career change, but it can look like the choices we make that allow us to be more free, more alive. I know I'm a better husband when I'm that way. I'm a better dad, certainly a better coworker. So the unfurled future, I think, is the opportunity of change. If we embrace change and live into it, we're like liberated to be fully us. And that's a great thing for the world.
In your experience, how do we know if we're not unfurled, right? Because I think people are like, well, not everyone gets to love their job.
Totally. Right?
Not everyone gets to do this. And so this, like, I wake up and get out of bed in the morning and I just like love what I do. Mm-hmm. I also think you can go through seasons where it's like, it's still what you're meant to do, but it's just a really hard season. 100%. And you're not pumped about it. Right. And so how do we, you know, what's the difference between those seasons of like, this is just really hard and I still believe in it, and like, I've lost my energy for that.
Yeah.
And yeah, I'll stop there. I have another question, but I'm just always really curious about that. Of how do we determine the difference?
I have a hard time understanding, at least for me, how I would determine the difference without people mirroring back how I was showing up in the world to me. Like those mm-hmm. closest to me, like, John, are you okay? Like I'm experiencing you in this way, and I can come up with their help with some characteristics of my furled self rather than my unfurled self. Sure. And sometimes our body tells us too, like, wow, my anxiety is really high. My stress is out of control. Mm-hmm. I am feeling apathetic or lethargic. Like, I think our body does, as some authors describe, keep score in a way that we have to listen to it. But I'm with you. Like it is a few things. There are seasons in life where you just gotta show up as healthy mm-hmm. and whole as you can, and you can't control if you're gonna do the dream job. The other thing is, it is largely a function of privilege, and I want to name that too. Like mm-hmm. Large swaths of our neighbors and fellow citizens in this country and across the world don't get to choose like their mm-hmm. job that allows them to be unfurled. They can choose an unfurled future based on how they show up in their life, but like the idea of choosing a job or a vocation is a luxury for some of us. And I want to acknowledge that I get to even consider that versus so many, like a lot of the parents at our kids' school, they're undocumented. They work two jobs each. Mm-hmm. And they're certainly not jobs that bring them a ton of life, but how they choose to engage them obviously can give them that. But if we have the luxury and the privilege, then I think we should take this seriously. That's the other thing, is like, we have an opportunity to bring to the world our best, and not everyone's been given this gift. So take it seriously and live into it.
Mm. I think that is such a good word, because I think with sometimes, and I know I'll speak for myself, I can feel, I can only do this because I'm privileged, and so should I, right?
Yeah.
I'm trying to like yeah. pretend I don't have it.
Right.
And that doesn't, and I often come back to like, that doesn't do us any good. It's not that I don't want privilege. It's that I want other people to have this as well. It's not that I yeah. don't want to be able to choose a vocation that brings me life. I just want other people to be able to do that as well.
Yeah.
And hopefully in my pursuit of my vocation, it creates more opportunities and space for others to pursue that. The yeah. other question that I was curious in somewhat relationship to this, but is I'll give an analogy. So I had an orchid. I tell this story all the time because it's just like such a good analogy for like all the things, right? But I had this orchid, and I thought for sure I was doing so good keeping this thing alive. It had flowers. It was green. I was like, look at my happy orchid. And then I took it to my mom's house because we were doing a renovation, and it was like, ba-bam, right? Like four new stalks of like amazing flowers, and it like grew 10 times bigger. And I was like, oh, okay. So clearly... it was not thriving. Yep. It was surviving, but it was not thriving. And I didn't know, because I hadn't experienced the difference, I didn't know how to differentiate between the two.
Mm-hmm.
How do you feel like that plays into, like, do we have to have experienced us unfurled to know that we're furled? Do we have to have had that type of experience? Or how does that play into, right? Like being able to identify mm-hmm. when we're in those moments or in those spaces.
Hmm. Man, that's a good question. I don't have a direct answer other than I think sometimes we need to be able to find moments to step out of our, whatever our inherited kind of status quo is, we have to be able to step out long enough to be able to evaluate it. Like I remember I in 2019, I had full-on anxiety attacks, one of them on a plane to Houston where I was going to go lead a retreat for a weekend, and instead of being at the retreat, I'm in the ER. Like, it was awful, and I don't think I was familiar with what that unfurled future looked like, but I knew that what was happening wasn't working, and so that's when I first walked the Camino de Santiago and was just for 2 weeks untethered from any kind of sound of phones demanding my attention on a path where no one cares about resume or CVs or titles or accomplishments. It's just like we're all in pursuit of some kind of healing or transformation or awakening. I think we need space to be able to listen to ourselves and to the silence. Sometimes the silence is where I can hear myself or God most loudly. Mm-hmm. Oftentimes it is. Or what, even if we don't have silence, like how is it we can disrupt our status quo just long enough to be able to tune in to that deeper frequency? Mm-hmm. I think it's inside all of us that says either something is wrong or there's something else out there. And mm-hmm. and then to have trusted people that can walk with us in that. Otherwise, it's hard for me to know how to discern that this is a survival orchid or a thriving orchid. Because I think a lot of us just live in lives that kind of say survival's enough. And mm-hmm. that's normal. And you just got to slug it out and make it to tomorrow. I hope that's not true for all of us, you know?
Well, I absolutely agree. I hope that's not true. I remember, Shannon Cohen, who's one of my favorite people on the planet, who's amazing. Mm-hmm. I reference her a lot. She has said something that I have put on a sticky note. She said, build what you've dreamed of, not what you've seen.
Mm.
And
that's good.
I was reflecting on this now having a 16-month-old, right?
Yep.
Who is like, oh, wow, a light switch. You know, totally. It's like, wow, look at
wonder.
Everything. You know, like yep. everything's amazing yep. and exciting. And we lose that. And how I so deeply believe to my core how important awe and wonder are to creating that opportunity and space for stepping out of yourself. And that doesn't always have to mean like going on a walk
totally.
Or, you know, a giant hiking trip. That is not everyone's cup of tea, right? Yep. You know, I can experience that sometimes, even when I'm like, when I think of Lord of the Rings, I experience mm-hmm. awe because I'm like, somebody created an entire world and like, enough, not just like in their brain, but translated that to some sort of drawing, like a map, created whole languages for these people. And like, that's just mind boggling to me that people can have that amount of creativity. Cause mm-hmm. that is so not my gifting. Like it's not my gifting. And so, right. Even just being open to like, I think that we sometimes, but you know, we just kind of succumb to, well, this is how it is for me because I don't have the resources. And there, it is absolutely a privileged space to be able to say like, I'm going to take a week and go mm-hmm. and do this, or I'm going to create space. There's absolutely privilege mm-hmm. in that. And I would say like some of my biggest like moments of awe or biggest moments of like, wow, that's amazing, has come through honestly just listening to other people's stories.
Yeah.
And allowing myself to be immersed in their experience rather than my own, right? Mm-hmm, even mm-hmm. just in that moment of, oh my goodness, they were doing all that and created this business. Like mm-hmm. I'm in awe. Like, could mm-hmm. I do that? Like, am I limiting myself by my own opinions or beliefs or what I've seen or, and then having community, like you said, that says, yeah, girl, mm-hmm. I think you could do mm-hmm. that. You know, like I had a friend when I first started my business, she was like, Mary, I think you're just being scared and you need to get off your butt and go do something. And I was like, okay.
Okay. Yeah.
You know, like you said, we need people who can just speak to us and say like, I see you and I know you're capable and it's not that you haven't thought this through and it's not that you're not clear. It's just that like, you don't want to yet or you're afraid of like it not going perfectly the first time you've done it. Mm-hmm. And at least in my experience, that's so much of what being comfortable with change is like that ability to see like that you are both not in control and you actually do have more control than you think. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like this balance of you have a lot of control over yourself, more than you think you do. And mm-hmm. there are tools and tricks and things you can learn about how to tell your body to stop it. Like, you know, there's lots of things that we can do therapeutically for that. And there's lots of outside of your control.
Yep.
And so being able to engage in change and conflict, at least that's been my experience between those mm-hmm. things.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any like other things, especially knowing that that you would give as folks give advice or words of wisdom that you would encourage folks to consider as they might be thinking about, like, how do I even get to know myself more to the point that I can have open hands?
Yeah, I think also pursuing those, we live in a pretty left brain world. Like, I gotta kind of think my way through what's coming. I think those moments of right brain too, that is more mystery, more paradox, more creativity, more color. If there are activities or practices that we can give ourselves there, and that could be in relation to stories. Like I'm thinking of, if I observe my four kids, our youngest Hank, he's only 9 minutes younger than his twin. But like when we walk on the beach, the bro is always 50 yards behind us because he's looking at every single shell and turning it over. And like, what is the thing in, if we observe that closely, what's bringing wonder to me? Like what's opening a portal in my head and my heart to wonder, and what might that mean for my future? I think other ones are pain. Like what we're currently in the midst of a war in Israel and Gaza. Not to put our, like, not just to look at those that are living a dream that I might have or that are flourishing, but who are those that are hurting? How are we getting close to the pain in our world and allowing our empathy to be stirred, our common humanity? And maybe inside of us, we discover that we have something to contribute to healing society in ways that lead to a future where those that are currently in pain or oppressed are finding freedom and liberation. And so I think there's, but those are feelings. Those are more, those aren't data points as much as stories that stir something in us, that allow us to feel, allow us to wonder, allow us to cry, allow us to feel pain. And I think those are the things that actually can catalyze change far more than trying to be convinced that you need to do something different because it might lead to XYZ change in a spreadsheet, which can be a motivator. But I think the more sustained soulful motivator are those experiential, right-brained, emotion-driven awakenings.
Yeah. Seeking transformation, not just adjustment, right?
Yeah.
Well, John, thank you so much for your wisdom and for your stories and your authenticity. I really appreciate your time today and spending it with us. As always, if you would like to get connected with John and hear more about what he's doing and how you can continue to learn from him, all of those links will be in the podcast description. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Oh, I just clicked. Hang on. I gotta go over here now, don't I? Sorry. No, I heard 45 minutes, nothing before that. Oh.
Thank you for listening to the Engaging Gray podcast. Hope that it gave you hope, encouragement, or tools that you can use to stay engaged in the ambiguous and messy reality we call life. For more from this podcast, visit grayspacecollaborative.com/podcast and follow us on social media to stay tuned for next episodes.